Rod Johnson.
Well, how's the world treating you, man?
It is treating me great. It's really great. Thank you. How about yourself?
I mean, for an old dude, man, who's been around for a long time, I'm very appreciative.
Well, you know what? We have to be, right? Because all we have is these moments. And, you know, I tell my kids, you know, if you can't appreciate this moment, then how can you get more?
Well, you know, I'm in a reminiscing stage because, you know, I'm extremely retired. You have a lot of time on your hands, and just to be appreciative, I'm using that word, you go back and remember things, you know, like my whole staff at my elementary school, they're all gone. In fact, you know, all the anyone who taught me in Alexandria is gone. And that's saying something, you know. And then you get to your college classmates, and it's your army buddies, and my immediate family, they all gone. They just, you know, and it, you know, you might drop a tear every now and then.
Yes, of course, of course. You know, we have to sometimes ask ourselves, what's the meaning of it all?
Yeah.
And the conclusion I have contemplating lately is that regardless of where we are, there's also still always just this moment. It's always the amount of attention we put into what we're doing right now, even if nobody's watching.
There are a lot of people, unbeknownst to you, that you possibly influence.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I'll give you an example. You know, these Black Fives era teams and players and photographs, those men and women were completely obscure for generations until now, but yet we're able to use some of those images to help inspire people today.
No question. All you got to do is use them prop, and it works for you.
That's
well,
right.
Go ahead, Claude. I don't want to keep you late. I don't want to keep you too long, you know.
No, I've blocked out the time, and
well, I'm cool.
Even though my wife, she's trying to fix some ribs, you know, I told her, don't knock on the door because I'm speaking to this.
Don't overplay your hand now, boy. And if they're not, there's some areas of sacrosanct, man. No, don't go up in there acting crazy with the ribs.
I know. That's true. I know. You know the deal. And she's definitely my better half.
Well, I'll tell you what. I've taken that better half to another level. I have an only half. Because
yes.
if you start recognizing the better half, there might be a lesser half stashed somewhere.
That's a good point.
I have an only half. That's it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Really good point. Well, so today we're speaking with Mr. Earl Lloyd, basketball pioneer. Mr. Lloyd is the first African-American basketball player in the NBA. Broke the color barrier in October 1950. And it's an honor and a privilege to speak with you, if I may call you Earl. We got a lot of things to talk about. We're going to squeeze it all in. But I just wanted to say that it's really great to be able to speak with you and for you to be discussing your book and life in general and your history and background and experiences as a true hero in the history of not only black basketball, but just basketball overall. How are you doing today?
I'm doing real well. You know, I'm 82, and, you know, I got all my faculties, right? And I feel fairly blessed. And I've said this to people. If the maker called me tomorrow, man, you know, I've had a good run.
Well, you may have a lot of energy still left, so I appreciate it. In case you don't know, as a listener to this interview, we've had conversations before. We've written up some things before. But what I'm really amazed about and what I appreciate is your new book, Moon Fixer, The Basketball Journey of Earl Lloyd. And I want to talk about that a little bit today with you because it's got all kinds of insights and history. It's a collaboration with a gentleman named Sean Kirst. It's a foreword that's in there from the mayor of Detroit, Dave Bing, who's also in the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Right.
And it's really filled with a tremendous amount of information that takes you back to what was the essence of this period that people can learn from today. And as you know, I mean, for BlackFives.com and for our company here, our slogan is Make History Now. So we're always trying to figure out ways to learn from the history, not just because it's interesting and fascinating, but also what can we do with it today that applies to people that can be helpful.
Well, this, you know, the book itself is, it just reflects on the human spirit. It really does. Because when I go home, you know, we sit around, it's not many of us left the Parker Gray High School. I mean, we had absolutely nothing. We didn't have a gymnasium. We had a little auditorium. We didn't have a baseball field, a football field. We had nothing except we had a magical coach and a bunch of young guys who were driven. And from that, I mean, Parker Gray High School is a story for another time, really.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about the book and who should read it. Who's it for?
Well, you know, I think this book, and I've been told this, this book should be required reading in every high school in the country because it really starts out. It doesn't start out in high school. I mean, naturally you got your parents and all that, you know, and grade school. But my first encounter with organized sports was high school basketball.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you listen at that and you think about the kids today, all these soccer leagues and T-balls and all that, and all that wasn't available to us.
Right. Yes. Yeah, that's right. And what are some of the reasons that you wrote the book? I mean, we know that you've had a tremendous career in basketball and coaching and mentoring and counseling and just being a community leader. But what made you write the book at this time?
Well, you know, I got a lot of prodding from friends and ex-teammates and my current family. And all they said to me was, if you can simplify things a bit, I can sort through them quicker. They said, look, there's a story to be told, and you're the only person getting to tell it because the other guys who would have shared in with you, they all dead. I mean, they're gone. So the story, if it's going to get told, you have to tell it.
Right.
I feel very, very proud, man, that I could speak out for these people, man, because they were outstanding people, man.
Yes. Earl Lloyd, he describes people that influenced his life, people that helped him along the way, some people who nobody's ever heard of and that are completely forgotten except for they made a huge impact on your life, right? I mean, we're talking about teachers, we're talking about classmates, and they may never have reached fame, but they certainly played a role, right?
Oh, there's no question. You know, it's amazing. During my time, when I got to high school, and you know, and you start playing sports, and you start exhibiting some things, that somebody's gonna want to give you a scholarship or something. But our parents were not equipped for that, mm-hmm. educationally.
Right.
So I was fortunate enough that my high school coach sent me to his school, West Virginia State College, on my Parker Gray High School staff. There were three people from West Virginia State. Coach Johnson, the boys coach, his wife, Mrs. Ruby Johnson, the girls coach, and Miss Smith,
mm-hmm.
who was the sister of Ruby Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
So they directed me to West Virginia State. And my attitude was, Claude, is that if this school to make me half the man that my coach was,
right.
it's a perfect fit.
Yeah.
And it was that and more. Because yeah. during my time as a college student, white schools were not taking us. So my school had to be much more than just an institution of higher learning. You know, it had to be a safe place.
Right.
And the one thing it gave us, and gave us that and more, it gave us a place where we felt like we belonged.
Right.
And believe it, man, during my time, and that was the utmost importance. We had to have a place.
I don't think people can appreciate that today, that the idea of having a place that's actually safe, considering the surroundings where one could take their life into their own hands by making one false move, correct?
Being in the wrong place at the wrong time and saying the wrong thing at the wrong time, you know. It it scares me a little, Claude, that our kids today don't think they need survival skills.
Mm.
There's always the need for survival skills.
And I want to point out that you have some special words and feelings in your heart that you reserve for your coaches, and in particular Coach Johnson. I mean, that was a different breed of coach, of person.
Well, you know, during my time in high school, Claude, most of the citizens, the largest cities in Virginia, they all had a favorite coach. So, and Parker Green was no different. Mm-hmm. And you know, this, when I say that Parker Green High School, in its own way, is a story for another time. Do you know, here we are in Washington, D.C., 8 miles from Washington. No, we're in Alexandria, 8 miles from D.C., and we're in Virginia. Mm-hmm. There's a school. We had 286 people, which included four grades of elementary school. Mm-hmm. We played in two conferences. Mm-hmm. We played in the VIAL, which was the Virginia Interscholastic Athletic League. And we played in the South Atlantic Conference. We played Dunbar High School and Cadoza, two very tough conferences, man. And we showed well. I mean, they had a name for us. They just called us the Blue Plague from across the river. So that tells you that we were hurting some people, you know?
Right, right. And not only that, but you had inferior equipment, inferior fields.
Everything.
Resources, everything.
Do you know, I tell a story. It is so, I mean, people don't believe it. Earl, we know you talk a lot, so you got to lie a lot, you know. I say, man, we go to play Addison High School in Roanoke, Virginia. That's a pretty good hall.
Yeah.
And it's football season, so it's inclement weather, right?
Right.
We're on the flatbed truck. You've seen those trucks with those panels that go around. We're on this truck. We got straw all over the floor, which is a hazard. Somebody hit two pieces of metal together, and everybody's going to burn up.
Wow.
And that's how we travel.
Right.
You know, and then, man, you know, when they dropped that separate but equal on you, I used to lay, it was funny, man. I said, man, you can't look at George Washington High School, man. They play a night football game. It was like broad daylight over there. And they had all the buses they needed. I said, wait, my senior year in high school, man, we had a tremendous basketball team, man. And you might not know this, but there's a high school in Nashville called Pearl High School. Mm-hmm. Pearl High School ran a tournament every year for the best black teams in the country. We got invited. No, we can't afford that.
Right.
Now, you know, if George Washington High School had been in it, they'd gone.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, I didn't get wise to things until about the 10th grade. And what happened in the 10th grade, I had an English teacher. She was a firm believer in current events. So to be up on current events, you got to do what? You got to read the newspaper every day.
Right.
And you start reading the newspaper, man, and you know, things start crystallizing. And you start asking questions, you know. And I would ask people in authority, what could we have done as a people to allow folks to treat us this way?
Right.
And, you know, somebody said, well, you know, it's a tough question because, I mean, the truth is going to hurt. One guy said to me, I don't know if it's a minister, coach, or whoever, said, you know, the Lord will test you. I said, man, you know, 300 years is a hell of a test.
No, when's this test over?
Can somebody tell me after all this time if I'm passing a fucking?
Right, or something, but that may or may not be totally true. I mean, it is true. Everything is a test, every moment. Look, I mean, let's face it, everything that happened led to where we are right now.
It's no question, man.
You know, we have a lot of things going right now. One of the things that Earl Lloyd talks about in Moonfixer is his involvement and observation of the campaign for president of President Barack Obama, and he has some opinions about that, which you'll have to get the book to read it because it's fascinating. His insights and commentary along those lines. There's a whole section dedicated just to that. I'd like to know how does it feel though right now to be an author? You know, a lot of people talk about writing a book. but you've completed the project, and you must have patted yourself on the back and said, well done.
Well, I'll tell you, the guy I pat on the back is Sean Curtis.
Mm.
I mean, Sean put together a hell of a book, man. I mean, I provided the fodder for the book, you know. This guy's a smart guy, man. You know, he's got a few awards for writing.
Yeah.
And we talked on the phone for 2 years, man, and he just had
it. Made it happen.
Yeah, he made it happen, you know. So yeah. I give him a lot of credit, man. But, you know, it was easy for me because I lived it.
Right. You write in the book that the Jim Crow era of segregation, as tough as it was, as difficult as it was, dangerous as it was, there was also an upside. Could you explain that?
Well, we got a tremendous education, man. We had an all-black school, all-black teachers, all-black everything. But what happens is the teachers who are teaching us, they know how hard they had it. So they knew exactly, they knew exactly what we needed, man, to survive.
Right.
And they gave it to us every day, man. And what made it easier for the teachers, man, is our parents. I come through an era, man, where anybody who's a position of authority, you would never challenge. No, you don't challenge them, man, then go home and tell your mother, I told Miss Day she was wrong, man. You get killed, man. I mean, my mother told me, you know, my dad was a nice guy, easygoing, quiet guy, you know. He wasn't quite as educated as my mother, and my mother only had about a fifth, sixth grade. But she said, look, and she when she got mad at me, she called me boy, or either Earl Francis. Either one of them would get hurt.
Right.
She said, boy, let me tell you something. You know, those teachers at that school, they're there for one reason. They're there for you.
Right.
That's why, that's their lot in life, man, to make sure you make it.
Right.
And then when you get out and go to college and graduate, then you got to be part of the legacy. You got to make sure somebody has a chance to make it. I think I've done that, you know. I tell people, I said, let me tell you something about my city, about my teachers. My whole school, from kindergarten to the 12th grade to 4 years of college, none of my teachers ever called me by my first name.
Hmm.
Never. It was always Mr. Lloyd, which made it very easy for me to call her Ms. White.
Right.
If you miss school, I mean, nobody ever cut school.
Right.
Because if you cut school, you're going to miss. You're going to miss all the fellas' activities for the day.
Well,
all the happenings was in the school.
Was in the school, but also if somebody, God forbid, saw you somewhere else.
God forbid, you said it right, boy. God forbid. And God forbid you don't say the wrong thing to that lady.
Wow.
And my mother said, you sass Miss Smith?
There's some of that missing. I mean, do you see some of that missing today? In other words, among youth.
You know, it's somewhere down the line, we made a turn, and we had a hard time getting back to it, because man, you know, and during my time as a kid in high school, man, I mean, the teachers got nothing but respect, man. And it's for the same reasons our parents told us. Look, you know, those people don't need you.
Right.
But you got an insatiable need for these people, man.
Yeah.
And without them, you know, you can't make it.
Right. There's something about that community support, self-support, which you do have that in some places and even in some neighborhoods. You know, the essence of that, how does one apply that? And I think part of it is one needs to have a very strong sense of community, involvement in the community, care about the community, understand what the issues are, understand what the weak links are, right? Because you're only as strong as your weakest link. These days, you know, that's why some places are so special, because it's really regardless of race or ethnicity or background or, you know, nationality, age, you know, what have you. I mean, if you're all in common after the same thing, wherever you might be, that's what brings you together.
At my college, my school was a fabulous place, man. I mean, it's at graduation, everybody's crying.
Of course, yes.
Somebody asked me, said, man, why are all the students crying? I said, man, they don't want to leave here, man.
Well, also, it feels like from your description in the book, I mean, you know, to use a sports metaphor, people left everything on the court. And they left. They put all, their all into going to school there, which means they applied their all.
Man, I tell you what, boy.
Right? I mean, they had to.
Anybody that came to that school who wanted to graduate is going to graduate, because these people are facilitators, man. I can recall a big time school out of Pittsburgh dispatched somebody, man, down to my school to offer me a scholarship. This person approached me and said, "Look, you know, they'd like for you consider coming to school. This is my sophomore year."
Right.
So I said, where was this school when I was a gangling freshman?
Right.
You know,
exactly.
Green as corn, you know, potential, but not ready yet. So Now what you want is, I became a pretty good player. I grew physically and emotionally, and we were like 33-0. So we played well.
Right.
I said, "Well, man, are they expecting a quick reply from me?" So this person said, "Yeah, you know, if you could." I said, "Well, tell them, why would I leave heaven to go to Pittsburgh?"
Right.
I mean, well, you know, that's why I'm in college, man, to make good decisions for myself, you know.
Right. And you, when you got to college, I mean, you were playing ball. You had some very successful teams at West Virginia State.
Yes.
And at one point, you were invited out to California, right? Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Well, you know, this is the first time that this particular team played against any white folks. And it was a good trip. We were I think we were like 2-3 or something like that. But what it told us was nobody beat us real bad. And it told us that given a chance to play against these people all the time, we would fare well.
Yeah.
And that kind of shaped us, because this is the first time in my whole life I ever played against a white person.
Well, just so you know, there was a trip that was organized by a promoter in California to bring West Virginia State out. And this was after you had your fabulous season in terms of your record and also the accomplishments of the team.
Right.
But no NIT invitation or anything like that.
No.
But there was a promoter who invited you out.
Frank Walsh was his name.
Yeah. What happened is that he ended up bringing you guys out to the Bay Area, San Francisco, to play again in the Cow Palace. Right. This was in 1950. And from what anybody could remember, it was the first time that Negro or colored teams ever played against interracial, against intercollegiate teams.
Yeah, that was groundbreaking.
You guys defeated Santa Clara, which is a great school back then. Were competitive against St. Mary's.
We played Bowling Green, man. Bowling Green, man, was a national power, man, in 1950.
Yeah. Yes.
And you know, the strange thing was, we played St. Mary's before we played Santa Clara.
Right.
St. Mary's beat us. And then the next night we played Santa Clara. We killed Santa Clara, man. You know, and then Santa Clara loses to St. Mary's, you know.
Right.
It was different. But it was, personally, I graded my team based on, you know, the kind of competition. And I really felt like if we played this competition night in and night out, we would have fared better.
Yeah.
And
I think your first game, you probably had some jitters. You had some jet lag.
Oh, man. Then they bring us the Oakland Blue and Gold. I don't know if you remember or not, Claude, but they had this industrial league, Phillips 66 and Oakland Business, you know.
The Business, yeah.
And the Business had Don Boxdale.
Who was
a UCLA All-American.
Tremendous team.
And I played him head up, man, you know, and I felt good about myself under Lova. I mean, we lost to him, but I said, "Here's a guy who is a big-time All-American, man, and we're going toe-to-toe."
Right. And he ended up being, you know, drafted and became the first African American All-Star.
Playing
an All-Star game in the NBA. I want to point out that there's a photograph of your team with Earl Warren, who was actually then the governor of California. Earl Warren, who later became the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Under the Warren Court, there were many groundbreaking civil rights decisions made. But there's a photograph of your team with Governor Warren. It's a wonderful, really almost priceless image. And you're right in there with the rest of your team wearing varsity Letterman jackets and sweaters. It's a beautiful photograph, and just wanted to...
That was a good time, man.
Give a shout-out to that.
It just tells you the kind of school I went to.
Yeah. Now, while you were in school, you mentioned that you had some basketball heroes, like the New York Rens, and you were very close to Washington, D.C., so you got to look in on
Bears.
The Washington Bears.
Right.
And I know you saw them play. Do you remember which players you remember the most
The two I remember the most, Pop Gates.
Yes.
Pop Gates is a legendary figure, man.
Also in the Hall of Fame.
I mean, man, Pop Gates did it all, man. And my second selection was kind of really personal. My name is Sonny Woods.
Mm-hmm.
Sonny Woods played with the New York Rens, but every Saturday and Sunday, they played at the Turner's Arena in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
The D.C. team, Turner's Arena, Lisman Brothers owned all the black movies in D.C.
Right. Abe Lichtman, and at one point or another, depending on what year it was, the Washington Bears were called the Lichtman Bears.
The Lichtman Bears, you know.
Right.
And the strange thing about it, man, they didn't have one player from D.C.
Right, yeah, they imported it, but they had a business going, you know.
No question, man. Well, Sweets played in that league. Sweets played with a team called the Dayton Mets.
That's right. Yes.
Right?
The Metropolitans, and he played there, and he also played for the Rens in those World Championship tournaments, right. Look, only a select few get into the NBA. First of all, get into college.
Somebody asked me, he said, well, how was your first training camp? I said, for the first time in my life that the playing floor was level,
right,
was training camp. And that's all because the ball, you know, you might have read this in the book.
Yeah.
The ball knows no prejudice.
It just bounces, right?
You don't know what kind of hands is coming through.
Right.
And it's not going to say, here come those black hands, get them away from me, you know.
Right.
And I'm talking to myself. And I'm saying to myself that all these years you think you've been mistreated. And you did. You were mistreated. He said, now, if you think you want to make a statement, now's the time, man.
Right.
And I told the guy, I asked the question, I said, let me tell you something, man. Not making that team was not an option.
Right. It's too much at stake. Too much.
And I tell you what, man, you go through the annals of the NBA drafts, and you're going to find one guy who was a number 9 draft choice that made a team.
Yes.
You're going to find one.
And we know who it is.
And we know who it is. Right. You know, you're going to find one, man. Man, I was on a mission, man. I mean, you know, like, my thing always was, if I can't reflect back to what happened to me in high school and all that kind of stuff, and if that don't make you just a little bit driven, man, you're not much of an athlete.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you, just to go back a second, because you mentioned Sonny Woods. What was it about Sonny that made you admire him? Was it his game, his personality, anything specific that happened between you and him?
No, nothing. I never spoke to Sonny. I mean, Sonny was just like, he was class, man. You know, I mean, when you saw him walk in into the arena with his street clothes on, I mean, he was New York personified.
Right.
And during those days, man, you said New York, man. New York was the Holy Grail.
Right. Harlem was it. I mean, that was it.
There ain't no question, man. The Harlem Five. Right. But Sonny Woods was basically a set shooter.
Yes.
And I watched him adjust, man, because the gym at I guess it was 14th and W, Turner's Arena. It was a fight arena.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And which means the ceiling is low, and this guy just adjusts like nothing ever happened, man.
Right.
He could shoot it. He could shoot it. And he was unselfish, man. He's a good ball handler, you know. I said, that's the kind of guy that you wish you could play for.
Thank you for sharing that. I want to finish with a couple of questions, beginning with what wisdom or thoughts would you share with today's players at whatever level, high school, college, NBA?
Well, let's do the NBA level.
Yes.
Every year, I get a chance to sit on a panel of old-timers, and you get to say a few words to the guys. We have some guys, man, who kind of hard on the youngsters, man, you know, because they're going to make a lot of money and all that stuff, you know. But I would tell them, I said, look, it's not how much you make, it's how much you keep, man. Whether you like it or not, man, you can be part of a legacy. And your legacy is, and I'm talking to a kid named O'Banion from UCLA a few years back. And he told me, he said, Mr. Lloyd, we owe you. I said, look, man, I said, whatever career I had, it has served me well. It really has.
Yeah.
I said, but you do owe somebody.
Yeah.
I said, now, I'm going to say to you, where can we go? You tell me one place where we can go where you can become a millionaire overnight. Just one stroke of the pen and you're a millionaire. We got to ride this horse till the legs fall off.
Yeah. He doesn't owe you. He owes the people coming after him.
Coming after him, you know. And they owe the people coming after them, you know. That's our legacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I made a point. Think about your favorite nightclub, the one that you like to go to the most.
Mm-hmm.
You say, and then what? I said, and don't go. I said, 99.9% of the problems I read about the basketball players who have problems outside the court, there's one common denominator, man. There's always a nightclub involved.
Yeah, it's a
nightclub. You're either in it, or you're leaving it, or you're out on the parking lot. Yeah, it's a nightclub, man.
Yeah. What do you want our leaders to do? We have a lot of leaders, for the most part, trying to do the best they can with whatever the cards are that are on the table to be played in their hand. What's your suggestion, advice, and thoughts?
First of all, if you said to me, Claude, Earl, I'm going to give you, you can do one thing to make this a better world. You say, what would you do? I said, man, somewhere we stop caring about each other. Because the more we care for each other, man, the better we do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that comes from having a feeling that we have something in common?
You know what happens? Every kid that is calling your name and not being disrespectful, he's crying for help, man.
Yeah.
You have to be smart enough to ascertain if this is a bad guy, is he crying for help?
Right. My mother always used to say, look for things that are in common, not things that are different. We can always find something different, but it takes a little bit more discipline to look for things in common.
My mother used to tell me, even when I left the house to go play in other cities, she would say, look, you go into a place where they will never meet this family.
Yeah.
But they will judge this family based on how you conduct yourself.
Right.
So do not embarrass this family.
Yes.
And, man, she wasn't talking about winning or losing. I mean, she was serious as a heart attack, boy.
No, that's right. It just had to do with your overall character and how you carry yourself, which you explain very well in your book. And I wanted to ask you, what specific charitable or educational charities or efforts are your favorite or that you feel closest to, you know, in terms of causes that are most meaningful to you right now?
You got to take it in NAACP, man. I mean, they've been out there for years, man. They've been in the trenches, man.
Yes.
No, the Urban League, they've been in the trenches.
Yes. We're going to wrap up by asking this last couple of questions here, which is, what would you like us to do with this early basketball history? Where are our efforts needed the most, and what can we do to make the biggest difference in the role that we play in terms of the future?
Mostly concerned starts middle school. Like, man, you got to start in first grade, because by the time a kid gets to middle school, you've lost a lot of people because they didn't get a good background from 1 through 6.
Right.
And see, what happens is that the kid that didn't fare well 1 through 6, he becomes a little belligerent, man. He becomes disruptive. And one kid can disrupt the whole class.
Yeah, yeah. And to your earlier point, this kid is probably looking for help, attention, is calling out. and may not be getting that at home.
He's crying for it.
Doesn't know how to really articulate that in school. Right. And if nobody's paying attention, then that can be labeled as just a maladjusted kid. But the kid may be incredibly intelligent, but just...
And he's crying for help, man. I mean, he's crying for help the only way he knows how.
Yeah.
He's trying to attract attention by being a nice kid, and somehow it didn't work for him. So he figured, look, if you raise some hell, you get some attention.
But I really appreciate your time. We're talking with Earl Lloyd, basketball pioneer, member of the Basketball Hall of Fame, first African-American player to break the color barrier in the NBA in October of 1950. This is the 60th anniversary, and he's written a book called Moon Fixer, The Basketball Journey of Earl Lloyd. And it's a wonderful book. It's written with Sean Kirst, forwarded by Dave Bing, the mayor of Detroit, also a Basketball Hall of Famer. Definitely get this book. It gives you lots of insights, lots of poignant storytelling, all the way from back then up to right now. Earl Lloyd, thank you very much, sir.
My pleasure, man.